Oak Creek City Council meeting to order of April 3rd, and we'll begin with the flag salute, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mayor Pruitt?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw?
Here.
Councilmember Bond?
Here.
Councilmember Todd?
Here.
Councilmember Cavallari?
Here.
Councilmember Mead?
Here.
Councilmember Steckler?
Here.
Okay, so we have nobody signed up for audience communication. Anybody want to talk to the council? You can, without signing up. One, once, twice. Okay. Next up is we have our exec here, Dave Summers. He did not bring Hewitt. But we'll live. Anyway, Dave, do you
want to
take it away?
Sure. Thank you, Mayor. Yeah, you kind of know who's really important with it. Where's Hewitt? You know, thanks for coming, Dave. But pleasure to be here. The purpose of our visit really is to kind of bring you up to speed and give you some background on what the county is doing regarding the opioid epidemic and some sort of new developments on that front. I'm happy to talk about at the end any other issues you'd like to ask about, but I didn't really come prepared to do a general broad overview, but more specifically opioids. So I have with me tonight Alessandra Durham, who works in my office as analyst on these issues, and Jason Bierman, who's my director of Department of Emergency Management. And they're going to do the bulk of the presentation. We have a multimedia extravaganza, I understand, PowerPoint presentation with some background. But stepping back before they get going, opioid epidemic obviously affects every part of the county. We've seen it growing over the years. And, you know, I live out in East County, out past Monroe, and it's certainly very visible there. North County, very visible. Everett, the reservation. There isn't really any part of our county that's not affected. And we have had a number of efforts over the years. It's not like nobody's been doing anything. But last year, it became kind of evident that there was a new energy level with our health district in particular, jumping into this issue, one that they had not been directly involved in the past. And they were charging off in several directions, and we had my Department of Human Services administering programs. We have the Sheriff's Office, and we have issues in corrections in the jail, and every city, every police department in the county is doing one thing or another. State's involved at various levels. So at the end of the summer, having a cabinet meeting, and Sheriff Trenary mentioned that his head PIO, Sherry Ireton, had been back at Emmitsburg, the FEMA Academy, for some training, and had done a special project. They were required to do a little paper, and she had the idea of taking emergency management structure that we implement during emergencies and seeing if she could apply that to opioids, and in particular, information, coordination of information dissemination. And everybody liked the paper. We invited her into cabinet, and she showed how incident command system, she had sort of applied this and showed how it could be useful, and we're all sitting there thinking, why couldn't we do this for the whole darn thing? I mean, ICS is something that we're all trained in, especially first responders. It's a well-defined organizational method for taking multiple agencies and resources and getting them in the same room and sort of deciding how to best deploy resources and identify who's doing what and set goals and objectives, et cetera. So I decided in consultation, particularly with the sheriff, to partially stand up our emergency management system and create a multi-agency committee, and you'll be hearing more about that. For the purpose of getting at the county level, Sheriff's Office, Human Services, the Health District, And at the time we first started, the City of Everett was very involved because we obviously have a large presence in downtown Everett and work together a lot. Get us in the same room and start to get a little bit more organized. So we've been doing this with no additional resources. It is an organizational method. The beauty of it, in my mind, is you can spend years arguing about organizational structure and responsibilities, and ICS is already there, and everybody gets it, and all that organizational stuff just kind of gets put to the side, and you can really focus on the issue at hand. So we've been implementing this since the fall, and we are now at a point where we want to make sure that we're communicating with our cities and other partners throughout the county, let them know what we're doing, and look for opportunities to grow the effort and bring in additional partners. So that's a little bit of the history of how we got there today. And I think, Jason, are you going to start off, or Alexander? Who's going to lead off the – okay. So they're going to walk through a presentation. I'm happy, again, at the end to take questions and talk more broadly about this, but I think it would be useful to go through the presentation at this point. How much time do we have? About two more minutes? Take three. All right. Jason?
You prefer me over there or here? Okay, I just want to make sure I'm not blocking. So, good evening. Jason Bierman, Director of Emergency Management for Snohomish County. Dave's done an excellent job of covering a lot of what I'm going to talk about. The multi-agency coordination group is a collaboration, and it's working and helping a lot of agencies who are working on this issue work together more closely. But we started with what was the problem, and you all see this in your communities. As the exec mentioned, the issue is everywhere in our county. So some of what you'll see behind me is some of the prevalence of opioid-related deaths, and if you can't see, there's heroin, prescription opioids, synthetic opioids, and then just regular street opioids. And you see these spikes, sort of the spike of prescription opioids, and it looks like the downward trend, but then an increased prevalence in heroin. And so that's part of what's happening out in the community. Breaking it down by quarter for the last couple of years, one of the early conversations we had, and part of what brought us to this as we were talking, as the executive mentioned, about activating our emergency management system, and the sheriff and I, who both obviously went through SR 530 together, talked about how in a very brief period of time we lost 43 lives, and that was a tragedy, and then within the last year we lost over double that number to opioids in the county. So the impact in terms of death and other impacts is palpable. Some of what is being seen in the emergency room, and this data is being collected, and we'll talk a little bit about how we're getting better at data collection and looking at all of it holistically. But some of what's being seen in the ERs, at least at Providence. And then in the jails. And so this is a 3-week time frame in January. And you look at those numbers, and it's pretty staggering when you look at total bookings at 365 for 1 week, and half of those, nearly half of those, are either there's a detox withdrawal watch for either opiates or heroin. So that brings us into the multi-agency coordination group. Again, the executive did a good job of covering a lot of this. We are working together more efficiently. We do have agencies in one room, and we are working within current resources to make our efforts more aligned and to support each other. And that really is born out of what we do during emergencies anyway. So we have a comprehensive emergency management at the county plan. It's a requirement for each jurisdiction. As part of your interlocal agreement with DEM, we help create yours as well. One of the things we plan for in our comprehensive emergency management planning is pandemics. So we were already planning for this long before it happened. Back in 2009, we activated a joint emergency operations center with the City of Everett in response to the H1N1 pandemic. So we also had some experience at doing this. And one of the things that plan does, and the executive touched on it, is the way we plan, we align functional areas with specific agencies. So we designate 15 different functional areas. We have a coordinating agency, which is usually a county department or the health district being one of them, and the sheriff's office is a separately elected. We make them coordinating agencies for the functional area, and then we ask them to do work within that function with all of the partners with whom they might have to work. So you can see this up here. So there's a coordinating agency for the function. They reach out to the jurisdictions. They work with private nonprofits, NGOs, others. And what we've done with this MAC group is bring them all, those lead agency representatives into one space, and that's our Emergency Coordination Center. So twice a month, initially every week, but now twice a month, we bring them in to our Emergency Coordination Center. We have the reps there in person. We discuss goals and objectives. I have staff that support them with the same processes in terms of planning and resourcing and the other things we do. The exec touched on the information management and sharing. We wrap them with the same processes that we do for all of our other disaster responses, and that helps let them focus on doing their work more efficiently. It targets goals and objectives, and then we have a support mechanism to make sure it all gets documented and that we're all working together and the same emergency management system we use for disaster response is being applied to this. It did start, the conversation started in late summer. The exec officially launched it in November with an executive directive, which has now been extended. Initially, it was going to go through the end of April, and it's now going to go through the end of November. And like I mentioned, we're meeting twice a month. One of those meetings we use to talk about our goals and objectives, and that's the next slide. Those are the seven goals that we all agreed to when we started out. You have, I believe, a copy of both the goals and the objectives. I just want to highlight, and I'm going to turn it over to Alessandra to talk about some of our successes. The key with this is we've got everyone focused on these seven goals, but underneath them are objectives that really are what we call SMART, specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and time-bound. You all are familiar with that. So we have an accountability system as well. So in addition to having everyone in the room, when we do those twice a month briefings, we brief out to each other about the progress we're making or the challenges we're facing. So there's inherent accountability in that because we've created these objectives, and that's how we measure the success and the progress we're making. So that's been very helpful for us as well to be able to benchmark what we're doing. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Alessandra, and she can talk about some of the successes we've had so far.
Good evening, Council members and Mayor Pruitt. Again, I'm Alessandra Durham with the Snohomish County Exec's Office. And so as Jason mentioned, we have seven overarching goals, and then which are intentionally broad, and then dozens of objectives that fall under those. And so I'll touch on a few of our key successes to date. So first and foremost is adding to our county and our community's toolbox. Before, because of the silos, information was really separated out, broken down, hard to access. And so what you'll see with a lot of the branding of Snohomish Overdose Prevention, it's actually .com. It's a website where all of this information, from data to resources to information about the MAC group itself and what we're doing, is all housed on that portal. It's updated frequently, and you'll see all of this information on there as well. Additionally, we're communicating with various agencies and programs and projects to make sure that the MAC group is feeding information to them, and we're receiving information in turn to ensure continuity and collaboration. Increasing access to naloxone and Narcan countywide. So our 21 law enforcement agencies, I believe Mill Creek included, is not only trained on how to administer, but they also are actively carrying that. This past legislative session, we successfully advocated for additional funding, and I believe that actually occurred statewide, but some of that money will be coming to Snohomish County to ensure that we can maintain that supply. It does have an expiration date. And these are just pictures of various law enforcement agencies going through the training that our human services and health district have developed. This is actually a great example of how the MAC works and how these programs can build on one another. So we just recently, in partnership with the Sheriff's Office and the City of Marysville, the City of Arlington, and Snohomish County Human Services, expanded the Office of Neighborhoods into the City of Marysville and Arlington. So now we have programs like this in Monroe, Arlington, Marysville, Central kind of County, Everett, and into this area as well. The pictures that we selected are interesting stories. The man that's in the corner here with all of the law enforcement officers, His name is Arthur. He was one of the first people to ever go through the Office of Neighborhoods programs. When they met him, he was recently discharged out of hospital from a violent assault. He was heavily addicted. He wasn't working. He was living in encampments. And now Arthur's one of their greatest success stories. He's working, gainfully employed. He lives on his own. He's clean. And he advocates for the program. This girl in the corner here, I met her in an encampment. She's 30 years old. She had been in the county jail, 3 days detoxed, and there weren't treatment spaces available for her. So she was detoxed discharged right back into the woods. And when we talked to her, she said, you know, it'd be wonderful if you guys had a program so that people like me coming out of the jail had somewhere to go so that while I was clean, I could continue down that path. And then here's a picture of one of the Office of Neighborhood teams, so the social workers and law enforcement officers working together. And the reason why I told that young girl's story is because of the diversion center. So we're hoping that this will be prepared for a soft opening in mid-April. There will be 44 beds available. Initially, the pilot program will target folks coming out of encampments and put them into a bed where they can begin the process of getting on methadone or suboxone and then identifying what their long-term treatment plan will be. Not only treatment from substance use disorder, but also housing, job readiness and preparedness, and so forth, so that they can be reintegrated back into society, reunified with their families, and become productive members of our community. So that piece of information, that story that that girl told us about, it'd be really nice to have a place to go, is becoming true because of this collaborative effort. We, through the health district, are also working with providers and prescribers of opioids. So Dr. Beatty, the public health officer, is now working with Providence Medical Center, Swedish, the Everett Clinic, dental providers, veterinarians, pharmacists, and so forth, to educate them on safe prescription habits and monitoring of people that are on long-term programs. And then also through the health district, they worked on a program, and they're at about three-quarters of the way of distribution of these safe walk bags. And so when someone is prescribed an opioid, they can go to the health district and receive one of these kits. It comes with a lock, and that way, especially in elderly or older adult populations, if they have family members coming in and out of the house, of course they can still access by cutting the bag, but at least they're aware somebody is accessing their medication. And can kind of be on alert sooner than later. And then also, again, through that effort about coordinated communication and that portal, the Snohomish OverdosePrevention.com website, we are making treatment information more readily available to the public and ensuring that folks get connected to treatment services sooner rather than later. With this population, when they're ready to accept help, you've got to act quickly. Otherwise, you lose that opportunity. So ensuring that bed space is available and advocating for more.
So how are you doing that? Because that has been a problem.
It's a significant issue. So the Diversion Center is really the first step, and that's only 44 beds. We also have the Carnegie Building, which is on the footprint of the Snohomish County campus, and that'll be a day center to help connect people to resources, and that could be everything from inpatient, outpatient treatment to job help, enrolling in healthcare, like insurance. And then we are also actively engaged in a project at the Denny Youth Facility. So the average daily population there has dropped drastically in the last decade or so. And so there's actually two modules inside of that facility that are currently vacant. And we are working to repurpose those sites, No Sight, No Sound, with juveniles and adults, to turn those into 16-bed detox facilities, so we'll have two of those. And the reason why we chose 16 is the federal standard. So that'll also provide 32 additional beds for detox that weren't currently available.
Has there been any improvement with like Evergreen Manor Drug and Alcohol for treatment centers? They provide services to low-income folks, but they're always tapped out.
They are, and so there's a few other providers that aren't necessarily residential or inpatient. But we're also expanding our partnership with Pioneer Human Services and Ideal Options to ensure that people have access to drugs like Suboxone or methadone to help them get on that path of like safely detoxing and looking at long-term options. So there's some work going on to fill those gaps. And then again, just a plug for our website. And this is supported by the MAC, and the content is filtered in there by the participants as well and agreed upon. But you'll find a lot more information about the work that we're doing. And we want to honor your time as well. So if there's any questions that you have for Jason or Dave or I, we're happy to stick around and answer those as well.
So just to add on, these are some examples of some of the sort of projects or programs that are going on. But, you know, at a higher level, last summer when we began this discussion, there was several groups headed towards having different websites and information portals. You know, the health district was headed one direction, our human services was headed another. We said, no, there's going to be one, and let's just come together and, you know, combine our resources, make sure we're speaking coherently and getting all the information. So it's a small thing, but it's a big thing because, again, we're focusing our effort. Another is in the issue of data and information. Again, there was violent disagreement on measurements and, you know, who should be collecting what and everything. And through this process, we have a process for resolving that and coming to agreement on what our measurement's going to be and getting everybody on board. And so those are they're kind of geeky bureaucratic things, but they are important efficiencies when you're dealing with a crisis of this magnitude. And so I think the model has shown it's a very good one. We're going to continue to grow it and build on it. But the sheriff likes to say it's to get everybody in their appropriate or their own swim lanes. And I think a better analogy, if you've ever rowed in a crew boat, you know, like an eight-person shell, got eight oars going, and when it's out of sync, it's miserable. I got to do that a little bit after college, and it's just horrible. But when everybody gets in sync and is rowing, that boat just picks up and moves. And you could think of your own analogy, but that's what we're trying to do is trying to get everybody to row in sync together and use the limited resources we do have as efficiently as possible, and also identify the key issues. You raised one, we can provide beds, but if we don't have the services there to also help, you know, bed is one thing, detox is one thing, but then that next step on it, whether it's mental health assistance or medical assistance or transitioning to jobs, housing, et cetera, there's got to be a progression of services that are all linked up on this path back to sort of a productive life that we hope to get people on. So there's a lot of pieces we can identify. What's the next critical point that we really need and resources and be very efficient on that. And so I think another benefit will be coming together forward together when we make legislative requests to the state or the feds saying, look, we've got all these agencies, we're in the same room, we all agree this is our top priority. So I think that'll be value in the future also. So
Questions?
Go ahead, Vince.
Thanks, man. Thanks, Dave. Thanks, everyone, for coming out. This presentation's fantastic, and it's great public service that you're doing here. I think this pie chart of opioid overdoses taken to ER is probably one of the more telling examples and is really good for public information. When we say the opioid crisis, many in the community, people that really aren't aware of the drug culture, like some of us that maybe do it for a living, they think it's grandma's medicine in the closet being stolen, and that is still the driving issue, so they're not taking it entirely serious. With the decreases of the availability of medications and whatnot, it's become very difficult, and it's costly. I mean, they can't buy pills anymore, so it's driven the price of heroin down is kind of what we have here. So going forward, I think that is an important factor to continue to drive home. Well, yes, it is opioid, and I know heroin's an opioid, but the battle is, I mean, we see it every day now. It's an anomaly. If we find somebody with pills now, it's every day. It's heroin, 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 and it's insane. Same thing with the needles. So fantastic job, and thanks again for what you're doing.
Jason, did you want to say something?
Yeah. I appreciate that. That data collection committee that's breaking down the barriers to getting a better look, I think one of the things you'll see with that as well is I think we all realize fentanyl is coming. And so we're able to, in much more closer to real time, being able to track and see how some of those things are going to be coming as well. So we've got some tools on that list of things that you saw up there that I think are going to help us be a little more proactive about some of these issues as well.
Yeah, thanks. That was a good lead-in, Vince. Thanks for starting that off. I think that is a good chart. I think a lot of things you hear about is, at least a few years ago, it was the pills that were getting stolen and were misused, a lot of fingers pointing at doctors, over-prescribing, and, yeah, we had some pill mills here in Everett that maybe made us focus on that. But I think you're right. People don't realize that half of this is street heroin. It's bad stuff.
Almost 80%.
Yeah, it is involved in all this. And so it doesn't diminish the problem, but I guess I think a lot of the news media gets focused on other stuff. People think, it's something else. I'm keeping my pills locked up, everything's cool. Well, you're keeping your pills locked up, that's good, but that's only a small part of this problem. So it's good that the health district is working on that. It's good that the public knows about it, but there's a big problem out here, and you guys are doing some good things. We keep hearing about the opioid crisis, and I personally think that the Snohomish County has a bigger problem in other places, and we don't want to hold up our hands and say we've got a bigger problem in other places. But I think that's true, and I think Snohomish County has also done some really good things. I think it was evidenced by the legislature giving you guys some money for some of the nice pilot programs you've got going. Are we unique, or are we an anomaly, or is this kind of...
So I don't remember the exact statistic, but we do have more than our share at the state level as a county for the opioid-related deaths. Do you remember the statistic?
So we hold 10% of the state's population, and yet 16.7% of the related deaths. So we do have a disproportionate impact.
And is Washington State different from the rest of the country,
yes,
too? I mean, I think I've heard that.
Seattle has been a heroin problem area for a long time, and Canada too, and we're borders, you know, being a border state, I think, I don't know how much that plays in, but Seattle's had a heroin problem forever.
Really? Okay.
They've been in the lead on that issue for a long time.
So Oregon is right below us as well. That's a big culture down there as well.
In California is, I mean, San Francisco is a horrible problem, but I saw an interesting map display of this last year, and I can't cite the statistics, but there are the highest concentrations were like I-5 corridor, but every major freeway up into or down into the country seemed to be, you know, it follows the distribution routes for this, so urban areas. This summer in August, went back to Indiana to visit family, in-laws, family, and southern rural Indiana. They've got the problem down there, you know, and it's touching every part of the country.
I mean, you hear about it on national news now. Opioid crisis, opium, you know. But I think the national crisis is,
yep,
they're now being aware, but we're apparently leading. We not a good place to be, but it's...
We're at the upper end of the scale.
Yeah. Thanks. You guys are doing good work.
Yeah, I had a couple of questions, and I have nowhere near the knowledge of some of my fellow council members here on the opioid and drug culture, so I'm a little bit of a neophyte, but I looked at the goals of the MAC group, and like the first three goals are very specific: reduction, lesson, lower. And I was looking at a lot of the outcome, and it seems to be a significant amount of services and support and in that regard. So I was wondering if I kind of missed: are there other programs in place to actually reduce the availability, to specifically reduce the drug counts? I missed it on the slides. And
yeah, so I think that's a great question, and Jason, you can help me elaborate as well. But with those goals, what you'll see are just overarching, very broad statements like reduce or lessen. When you dig into those objectives, you'll have things that are measurable. So it'll say, for example, one of them is reduce opioid-related crimes by 10%. And so using that as an example, the sheriff's office worked diligently to define what an opioid-related crime, first of all, is, and then target some of their response to those, responding to those activities, or how we treated those from a criminal perspective. So there's a lot of work going on where we dig a little bit deeper into just that lessen or reduce, that being one of the primary tasks that we focused on.
Yeah, and some of those, when you look at them as well, some of the objectives within that are longer-term objectives as well, because some of that work takes a longer time to succeed to fruition, so part of it, what we've been doing is trying to make sure we're operating and prioritizing from a good data baseline. So just getting those people, again, back in the room, having shared definitions, like Dave mentioned, it's kind of a bureaucratic thing, but at the same time, having a shared definition of, for example, a nuisance property helps you understand how big the problem is, where the problems are, where to target the efforts. So some of these things in those first three goals are longer-term objectives, but the work is still being done. It's just not, it's not what we've chosen to put up here as examples, but it's, there are a number of them that fall underneath those goals.
So it could be that the activities that are taking place today to support, reduce, cure will provide outcomes that will achieve the goals of 1, 2, and 3. We're not really working on...
Modified by the discussion at the MAC group. I mean, the part of this is having a larger holistic discussion. So if the sheriff is changing his practices, he's not de-emphasizing law enforcement in any way, but as Jason said, they're focusing now. They have some measurements and understand exactly, you know, what to target. So there is changes in behavior at our level.
The other piece that I would add to that is you will see that this is pretty service-oriented or pretty heavy on the services. And what we're dealing with is a very high-needs population with co-occurring disorders. So oftentimes what you'll see is substance use and mental health components or substance use and something else. And in addition to that, it won't be just one substance. So oftentimes when we drug screen folks that we're interacting with, you'll see methamphetamine and opioids and marijuana and alcohol. You'll see a lot of things on board on one individual. And so from the services piece, you kind of have to touch them from multiple points to get to some of the desired outcomes.
So what we get this question a lot. We're not de-emphasizing law enforcement, but for many of the folks we're dealing with in the examples we showed, these are people that are often homeless, might be involved in minor crimes, property crimes, end up in the jail for a short time, get put back out, happens again, end up in the jail, get put back out. What we're trying to do with the Diversion Center is provide a pathway saying, look, you can go back to jail, we know this is going to happen again, or if you're ready, we have, you know, this other option for you and when they're ready. So it works hand in hand with enforcement and those other things, but it provides another pathway out because we're trying to break that cycle for the people that will be helped, but we're not de-emphasizing law enforcement.
Thanks. I'm going to follow on to Councilmember Steckler's question. So I'm looking at goal number two, because I think this is where you were going, or maybe I'm wrong. Goal number two is lessen the availability of opioids, and the three objectives that are listed here are pretty much all things the health department is going. We're going to go educate the pharmacists, educate the doctors, educate the vets. Okay, but that's only a tiny part of the problem. I would expect to see an objective in here that says we're going to do something about reducing the amount of street heroin that's out there, because that's the bigger part of the problem. And this is where the doc, my sister's a doc, you can drive her nuclear. If you focus this, she says, this, I'm not the problem. I'm doing a good job of prescribing opioids when I should. The problem is the street drugs. And so are there other programs, or this is just in work in progress? I'm assuming that there's other objectives related to reducing the street drugs.
Yeah, there's actually an objective under what you'll see is ESF 13, or the law enforcement component. And so several months ago, state investigators from the Medicaid unit came to a police chief's meeting, and what Sheriff Trinari saw was that we have pharmacies in this county where if you overlay a map of those pharmacies with the deaths that are occurring, they're oftentimes within 1 mile of our most problematic distributors from a legal perspective.
Okay.
And so there are some objectives that are tied to enforcement with pharmacies and ensuring that they're complying with state and federal standards. Part of that is waiting on legislation to change at the state and federal level. So I think from a county perspective, we're ready to pursue that, and we're just waiting for our partners to support us on the legislative side, which they've been wonderful about those conversations. And so I guess to touch on a couple of points, yes, heroin and fentanyl are definitely in our community, and it's a tremendous problem. And we're seeing a decrease in the prescription opioids and the deaths and overdoses related to that, because you're right, the cost associated with a pill versus street drugs is drastic difference. However, with this population, a lot of times it's long-term addictions, and so we still have folks that kind of enter down that pathway through the prescription route, and so we haven't neglected also addressing that. So there's two components to this.
So if, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there's a premise, some assumptions that are made. One, this problem didn't happen overnight. It was 10 or 15 years in the making. And the problem is not today's abuse of the prescriptions, because we woke up, we started addressing it. It's 10 years ago. And these people started, they didn't wake up and go, I'm going to shoot some heroin today, woo, or I'm going to smoke some heroin. They got addicted to pills through some bad practices or whatever, tragic circumstances or whatever. And then we said, oh, wait, we're doing wrong. We're not going to give you those pills anymore. But we didn't necessarily go and say, by the way, we're going to treat your addiction to those pills. And now they're, that's how they got from A to B, okay. Heroin. So now that they've transitioned to heroin and the demand for heroin's high because the pills have been removed. If that, does that make, that's what I think is going on from what I've heard some experts saying is trying to address. So this started 15 years ago. We're just reaping the consequences of some bad practices over the past few years.
That's exactly right. And one of the things that was eye-opening to us and part of these MAC group discussions was I started having conversations with the medical examiner's office more frequently. And so housing is also a component, right? People need stable housing in order to get clean and sober and continue down that path. And what we see in the housing world, or what we always hear, is 18 to 34 white males are in need of housing. So when I mentioned that to the ME's office, they said, well, no, the people that we see coming into our office are 42 to 44. So that just shows you how long this path can last for someone before it ends in tragedy if help isn't administered. So that 10 to 15-year lag is consistent with what we're seeing.
You said that you were going to take people straight from the camps and get them into beds and treatment. What about people coming out of the jail?
Yeah, that's a great question. So with the Diversion Center project, that we have 44 beds, which is tremendous. It's 44 more than we had, but there's capacity. And so the other piece of this is that Carnegie building coming online, because people transitioning out of the jail can go straight there and start to get connected with these various services like Ideal Options or Pioneer that can administer these same medications that we're giving inside of the Diversion Center on an outpatient basis until we can connect them with an inpatient facility, if that's the pathway that they choose. There's various routes to treatment. Some people choose abstinence-based only. Some people do just fine with an outpatient program. Maybe they go to group 3 days a week, and they're also working with mental health and chemical dependency providers. And other people may need 30, 90, 120 days in an inpatient facility. So it'll vary depending on those folks, too. Yeah, so I can't speak in totality to that because part of that is under the sheriff's kind of purview. What I can say is that the jail has begun administering medication-assisted treatment, so the same Suboxone, Methadone-type programs that I'm talking about in these other facilities is now being administered in the jail, which reduces the burden on the medical ward. So we were using our jail as the largest detox facility in the county, which, of course, is not what it's designed for. But by administering these drugs, we're not having people on intense detox watch. They're able to more safely do so. So I think you'll see a reduction in some of those refusals. But, again, I would defer to Sheriff Trenary.
We have seen a reduction in those refusals. The ability of the jail, and Vince can speak to this, but the ability of the jail as a road deputy that brings people to jail, the refusals are less now. They still only have X amount of medical beds. So if they run out of beds, whether it's in the medical or the whole jail, even sometimes they just say, look, we're at capacity. We're not taking women today, or we're not, unless it's a violent, mandatory arrest, violent offender type thing, that they'll say, look, shoplift or something, refer them. We don't have a spot. So it's the same with the medical beds, but that is less now as we've gotten better with our ability to work with them. So we're not getting that as much as we were about 6 months ago, where we were still trying to find ourselves. Yeah, I'll be quick. Councilmember Bond is correct. There's less of a refusals at the door. So that's, I think the programs so far are a home run. I think the, I know that's, I hesitate to say that because we're so early into the phases, but the, seeing the Suboxone, the methadone firsthand, and even if you want to throw the ONES in there, the naloxone, of being able to stop the overdoses, we have drastically reduced the number of ER trips from the booking area. It's astounding so far, just these early touches. And the transitional housing that's going to go in now for those additional beds until they can get into treatment, secondary housing, or whatever their goal is another good step. And that's what we're doing, is we're poking, you know, little holes in the balloon, hoping it'll finally break. But one of the questions I did have was about the when it came to with information that we also include the diseases associated with the HIV, the hepatitis. I think that's a good public awareness issue to bring up, especially when it comes that they're sharing needles 24/7 and the uptick in the numbers that they're seeing of cases. And that, it's my understanding that hepatitis is kind of making a comeback now, when we've, now that we were able to, you know, knock it out, and same thing with HIV. So I'd like to see those numbers in here as well, if possible.
Yeah, if the health district was here, they have that information. And yes, we are seeing a corresponding increase in Hep C. HIV, not so much, but they attribute that because there's better treatment available these days than there has been historically. So what's happening today is not exactly comparable to what happened, say, 20 years ago. But no, you're absolutely right. There's a huge public health side of this and disease side of this that is part of the discussion.
Talk to Dr. Beatty. I mean, they don't. I mean, that's part of what we're trying to get at with this data collection committee, and being able to talk to each other about what EMS is collecting versus what the hospitals are collecting versus what the sheriff's collecting and law enforcement community. We hope to get to that. And there's also the point in time that's going to be done this summer. So there's another effort that's going to be made. But right now, it's really difficult because it's in so many facets of the community. Like you said, some of it's still hidden. But we're trying to get there as quick as we can.
There's 2 points. Time counts every year, and the winter one's homelessness, and July is aimed at these issues, drug-related issues. So we should have a better count. But triggered one other thing in the medical examiner's office. We didn't have consistent testing, so we don't really feel we have a good number on how many opioid-related deaths there are, and there's a bit of a bottleneck or a delay in processing, and that's one of the focal points in getting that fixed. And the medical examiner is totally tied into this, and we hope to have in the future much better numbers about opioid-related deaths.
May I? I want to close with one thought for you, to encourage you guys and our council. So I've been a police officer for 28 years, and started with the city of Mill Creek, now I'm with the sheriff's office. And what I see is that many years ago, I would run into people, and they might know somebody, they heard of somebody, it was, I read in the paper someone died from heroin. What I hear today, what I see today, everybody I talk to, they know somebody, someone in their family. I mean, it's not that far removed anymore, and so it's not viewed as the, it's tragic, but it's not viewed as like, well, that's somebody else's problem. They realize it's my problem, it's my neighbor's problem, my neighbor's struggling with that, people I care about are struggling with this, and so they are supporting us and saying, do something, please. They're behind it, whereas I think 20 years ago, it's not my problem. That's a heroin is a
that's a, you know, some bad person does that, and I don't know any bad people, but we're a lot more enlightened today, and we realize there's some good people that are struggling with this, and we need to help them. We owe it to them to help them and their families. And what you're doing is great.
Everyone was the boogeyman back then, and now we realize the boogeyman.
I've had two people in my own family affected by this. One went through the prescription drug entry portal related to pain control and got hooked and was able to finally beat that. It was my father-in-law. He's passed now, but he was a Boeing engineer, went to Purdue, straight-laced, pocket protector. You know, this guy was, but he had a terrible back, you know, from younger days, and he got prescribed opioids and got, and another family member with some mental health issues, it went the other direction. It was more towards the street drug side of it. But, you know, there's a lot of different pathways, and we recognize that. And part of the beauty of the system I think we're building is we're starting to understand that each person is an individual, and they have a different history, and they have a different set of needs and a different path that they need to get on to get out of this. And you can't treat them all the same. You need to understand what's going on with that person and help them move past this.
This is nurses, doctors, cops, firemen, council people. It touches everybody. There are people that you work with that are struggling with this. You don't know it. They just hide it better than some of the other folks. But it will, eventually, it catches everybody.
Thank you.
Cue it.
Before we go, if I can add one more point, is there is an opportunity for cities, towns, tribes, and others to plug into this effort. There's kind of two logical pathways in, and one is putting your staff in under emergency support functions or even objectives where you think it's of benefit or in alignment with the city of Mill Creek. Another option or route to go is to stand up your own effort that parallels this and bidirectionally feed information. And so if either of those are of interest, Jason or I are happy to answer questions, although Jason's the expert on the structural piece, so we would love to have that conversation. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wanted to cover the last goal of the long-term planning. The next council meeting, we'll actually be providing you an updated workbook that has all the information that you have brainstormed over the past several weeks. And we'll talk, just kind of go through those and then talk about why those strategies or those initiatives that you've identified are important. As staff, it's important for us to know why these things are important to you so we can communicate those, message those, and develop additional priorities. I'm going to be sending something out. I think I've set aside a day on April 20th to do some work on wordsmithing the strategies that we've brainstormed here. And because they are your strategies, if you'd like to be a part of that, let me know. And be happy for you to join me in that effort. The last goal to discuss in our brainstorming sessions is the long-term planning. And I just, I think this is really significant and requires not just discussion tonight, but several conversations with the council I was obviously new when we were talking about this, and now I've had the benefit of a couple years to learn a lot about the development of the city. And I think that this is an important goal, not just in the sense of planning is important, but I think because the nature of the city has changed so much. You've gone over a 20-year period from having so much vacant land that I think, at least my perception is, that the focus was internal in terms of developing Mill Creek. I think a lot of our planning effort now has to not just be continue to develop or redevelop Mill Creek, but really be aware externally to Mill Creek borders what's happening and how that development could or will impact Mill Creek and how we want to plan for those impacts as well. And that you may planning for that may be adjusting infrastructure internally, maybe annexations to control land use, maybe a variety of things, but I think that's where a lot of our discussion in the coming years has to focus, is those external developments and resulting impacts internally to Mill Creek and what has to be done to protect Mill Creek in the sense of what you've identified through your other goals, like community preservation. Gene, I'm assuming everyone has pens and paper. Is that right?
Some people cheated and already filled out their
Oh, awesome. I love
handwriting.
Love good living. Yes, that's a good use of time.
It's been more fun watching Greg try to find my hieroglyphics.
We're going to get through long-term planning.
You got the bug? Everybody I know is struggling with it.
I believe, yes, that is it. I think that's a Friday, April 20th.
And
that
will so. Be during the day, so.
Yeah, it'll be all day. So come for all or some.
Same brown felt pen back in 3 weeks.
So they're not as grouped as they've been because there's a lot of really diverse good ideas up here. So I'm going to start at the top. Long-term fiscal planning is essential to ongoing financial stability. Protects constituents from volatility and taxes. Kind of a planning thing. Plan and control our destiny. Tools for planning. What is the connection between current future opportunity and future and current needs? Now that city has done some strategic planning and identified marketing framework, parentheses, tourism and sports tourism, look broadly at city Brian?
What I was trying to get at here is I remember, I think it was in early 2014 after the election, we discussed the issue or idea of bike paths on Village Green Drive.
Yes.
And, you know, something that I know the mayor and I heard on the campaign trail in 2013, and staff put together some information, brought it to us, and we ultimately decided not to do it. But I think it was more a dollar and cents issue. And then in 2015, we hired Rebecca, and we started this process. And I remember mentioning in passing, or I don't remember how it came up, I mentioned to Tom Gathman, maybe we should revisit the issue of the bike paths. And he just bristled. It's like, I've brought that to you guys twice before, and you've rejected it. Why would we consider it again? And my comment to him was, when we considered it last in 14, when I was involved, we had no framework. We had no guiding principles to put an issue like that in context. And so we looked at it in terms of dollar and cents. And at the time, we decided it didn't make a whole lot of sense to pursue that. Now that we've identified a vision, I don't know if we would change our outcome, but this kind of fits into what we're trying to do. So the concept here was look at that and other things that we have considered before and maybe rejected, or other ideas we haven't considered, and see how they fit into our guiding principles and whether they make sense.
I think that's really important, and I think it's important when you connect that to long-term fiscal planning, because when you have the guiding principles connected to a capital plan, you know, then you can start looking. You know, Gene and I were just having this conversation our last couple one-on-ones. you know, because the calls for grant money are 2 years, sometimes before the monies are available. But when you know that you have projects for the next 10 years and you know what your overarching guiding principles are, you can start to get creative when those grant calls come and what you may be able to explore and do where you otherwise wouldn't really even ever think of it. And so I think that's a great point.
Also in the planning corner here, plan for pride and a successful community. And then kind of dovetail to that is survey residents for current and future needs. So as we plan for pride and successful, we want to know what the community thinks that might look like. This is its own idea. Can we define our future in one word as to what we want to be? For example, a smart city, a connected city, a livable city, or insert whatever description of city you want to insert.
It's just the power of, if we could get to that point in our planning, who we are long term. If you ever define that down to one word, there's such strength and power in that. And you can grow objectives off of that one word. It creates a rallying and a cohesive vision for everyone. Not saying we can, just it's a great goal.
Going over here, focus or emphasize long term to match our vision. Focus on or emphasize long term to match our vision. Set realistic goals and create a 5 and 10 year list of goals and objectives that we want to accomplish. Explore opportunities with the Everett School District for their property on east side of 527 south of Old Seattle Hill Road.
Can I speak to that really quick? I mean, we talked about, I think you brought this up before, the gateway from the south, which doesn't really exist. The school district, if you can picture Old Seattle Hill Road, and then to the south is 173rd, which is the northern border of that residential development. The school district bought that property years ago, and for the life of me, I have no idea what they ever plan to do with it because it's not big enough for a high school, and they don't have the money for high school. And they're never going to put an elementary or a middle school on Bothell Everett Highway, but they just sit on the property, and it is a large, I don't know how many, it's got to be 20 acres. It's a big chunk of real estate, and it's, I think, the last big undeveloped piece in the city, and I'm not sure that what planning or if we need to relook at it and talk to the school district about whether there's some opportunity there.
Is that in the city?
It's not in the city.
It's not in the city?
South, right? Just
no.
North of
180th. Is our border Seattle Hill Road?
No, our border is Nickel Creek, which is north of that. So all the new apartments are being built is all outside the city. And Ingar's whatever property was.
That it fits into my post-it about working at the annexation boundary when Pond's Casino into the city.
So a number of years ago, we changed something about our MUGA about planning to accommodate, I think, mixed use or something or other that was amenable to the school district. We talked to the school district and said, look, we'd like to make this something in the future plan. I can't remember exactly how we did that. I don't remember the
plan. Well, then I would revise my post-it to say we should work with Snohomish County and Everett School District and maybe come up with an interlocal where we can control what happens with that rather than Snohomish County, because we know that they citizens haven't been happy with what happened up above them.
Yeah.
Default annexation?
Mm-hmm.
If we buy the property from the school district, kind of makes it our control, not really annexed, but...
This is indeed a long, I'll just say it's a long-term discussion. I served on the school district's capital facilities advisory committee for a long time, and they just don't really, that's land banked for them.
Yeah, I get it, but they don't get it.
They won't even talk about it, so it doesn't mean we shouldn't, but they're definitely long-term.
And they're never going to get heard on that. So I moved that down here with the other comment. revisit annexation policies, identify goals for...
I don't remember.
I brought my glasses up here.
Want to borrow mine?
My goals for potential annexations and have a particular annexation and how a particular annexation would replace...
The gist is fitting in with our future goals. I think this fits into the conversation we had a couple years ago, and we were talking about 164th. Is, you know, the whole issue with us and Linwood is going to come back at some point. But I wouldn't advocate annexing for the sake of annexing, but we've got, if we're going to consider it, we've got to come up with what the vision of the city is going to be in 20 years to see whether or not that fits into it. And that applies whether we look west, whether we look south, whether we look northwest. But I think we need to start that visioning process to figure out what we might or might not do.
There's a, right next to that, consider annexation of surrounding land, and then parentheses up 164. So that fits right into what you're discussing. We'll go right to the middle here. Work with county, state, transit agencies on transportation, connections, jobs, shopping, education, entertainment, etc. Support, encourage appropriate economic development to ensure strength of local economy long term. Isolate current and future trends to base our planning on. Do not jeopardize our identity. Yep, it's in the wrong spot, but back to the annexation discussion, fresh look. Our policies are outdated. At annexation areas, northwest area around Swedish, south along 527 to 180th, and west along 164 to I-5. And then continue to reevaluate. Don't be afraid to be a planning leader or be different. Don't be afraid to be an oasis or ignore outside reality. Collaborate with our surrounding cities to plan for growth. Work with county and neighboring jurisdictions on development, redevelopment, zoning to accommodate growth in the urban growth area. Can we look at success stories from other cities? Identify and strengthen our regional partnerships to provide services that our citizens expect.
So, just listening to these, I think a lot of these are somewhat projects and initiatives. The one that really, or a lot of them are things we've talked about under other goals. The one that really stuck out to me is don't be afraid to be a planning leader. Because I think that's a lot, to me at least, what this goal speaks to. This is really, to me, this goal is a leverage to achieve your other goals. And sometimes that does have to put you out there to be a leader. You know, we've talked a lot about wetlands and how those are negative impacts in when, from a stormwater perspective and the beavers. But there's an opportunity there to capitalize on those to be an amenity. And so there might be some projects or things to do that we bring forward that might be in that catalyst of being a planning leader. Might be property that you want to preserve adjacent to the city, where you may want to use conservation futures to do that. To go towards maintaining that look and the feel. The annexations, again, you know, I like evaluating the criteria against all your other goals. Does it help you achieve some or all of those goals? And again, you know, you've kind of are building this framework step by step with these guiding principles and now the meat underneath it. To me, that don't be afraid to be a planning leader speaks a lot
a lot to this goal. A lot of the other stuff was good, but I put it more in the initiative or project category. So I'd like to hear how much the council as a whole feels about that, being a leader, stepping out front from a planning perspective.
You know, being the newest member of the group, I was trying to educate myself as much as possible on planning, and I went online and just started Googling, studying, trying to find city growth plans, strategies, long-term planning, success stories, anything and everything to try and, you know, educate myself. And what I found that was interesting was those one-word comments that I brought up there, those were actual examples of various cities. And when I read things like a smart city and a connected city, that was stuff that wasn't even in my mind, thinking about that would be a platform for a city's growth. But what the article I was reading stated was, what you're saying, Rebecca, was truly 10 years from now, what will be the strength of a particular city today? Nobody's thinking about it. Mm-hmm. So everything you know today probably won't be reflective in that strategy 10 years from now. It's going to be something so totally different than what you thought it was. And I'm trying to think if 10 years ago, Mill Creek, and I was here, when we were a bedroom community and not a city, would we ever thought that someday we'd be a city with a town center, with our police department, with our, you know, all of our own services, and yeah, it really wasn't on the, you know, it was a cool place to live. It was a development that somebody put out in the middle of the woods, and it has become something we never thought. So I do think you're right. We do need to be, we need to think and not be afraid to say that really what the future is going to look like probably isn't a word that we're currently using today, but, you know, will be very, very important 10, 15 years from now.
Well, I think what Councilmember Todd said in some of her previous planning, you know, about just, you know, going to what you just said is, what was it when you guys started the city, and what are we now? And that's why I feel so passionate about this planning process and building a vision and a mission statement and these goals, is because you really want to then leverage this goal, this planning, of how do you achieve that vision, right? How do you create your future? And not just do the same things you've been doing day in and day out, because that's just maintaining the status quo. But how do you plan for, embrace, create a destiny? And I think that this goal really helps you do that. But when you are creating something new, a lot of times you're doing something new for the first time. And that's why whoever wrote this, you know, don't be afraid to be a planning leader. I thought that was very provocative.
Before we had our first comprehensive plan, and I was secretary of the land use subcommittee, there are people that have visions. And there were a lot of members of our community that came together on a variety of committees. And Dr. Larry Schmidt and a planner or a builder by the name of Mark Benn were the ones who suggested the town center. And it looked different than what they suggested, but yet it's very much the same. And I think that they had a vision. It took 20 years to realize the vision. And we can't be afraid of, they stepped up and threw their idea out. Other people came along and improved and built on it and what have you. But I just would hate to see us get 20 years down the road and have people look back at our work and say, what were they thinking? And have it be negative. I'm hopeful that whatever it is that we lay the foundation for the people that come after us, and we can't be afraid to think of something different or do something different. Maybe we learn something, like John's saying, we find something someplace else. I don't know, but there are people who do it. We can step out, and we can be leaders for the rest of the county and the region.
And I think the city actually has done some of that, and sometimes we don't think about that. I mean, we talk a lot about the town center, but that was a vision. You know, I think it was visionary when the council bought the building next door, thinking about how the city would grow and needing extra space. I mean, it's a pretty good position to be in when you're growing and you don't have to build or expand your city hall. I mean, and you had the ability to create a campus.
already been.
Dobson Remillard.
I was just going to say, Dobson Remillard. And now, you know, this council has the ability to really create a vision from that pre-planning of buying that land from previous councils. So I do think the city has had a history of planning and thinking for the future. And I think the difference is when the city did those things, it was very young, tons of development room, lots of cash coming in. Different opportunity to try to manage, create a vision in a very tighter budget. And so that's one of the reasons we really focused on that short term, balancing the budget, and working now on building that long term financial plan so you have the strength to do that visioning.
Thank you. So I like everything the mayor said and our city manager, and I love the innovative, out of the box, different way that our city manager is bringing us to the next level. So I love what you're doing. I will be honest, I get a little nervous when I hear Milk Creek's going to be the leader. As a citizen, and a lot of my neighbors and people I talk to, they're pretty happy with what we're doing. And they don't really want us maybe going off in any crazy tangents. Seattle, I think, would say they're leaders in a lot of things. And a lot of what they're doing, to be honest, is silly to me. And I wouldn't think that that's the kind of leadership that I would want us here. And I don't think it would be well received by our citizens. But that doesn't mean we should not be innovative, open to new ideas. So I'm trying to wrap my head around, what does being a leader in planning mean? Taking the point and racing out in front of everybody else. If we do it right, we're heroes. If we screw up, we can make some costly mistakes. Well, I don't know. I'm just struggling with it.
Your leader, though, is defined by your guiding principles. You know, that vision statement, those goals. I think the city was a leader when it had the concept of the town center, and look how much notoriety the city gets for that. I don't think leadership has to be synonymous to crazy. I think that leadership truly can be, leadership as it fits your community. I personally think that one of the virtues of leadership or demonstrations of leadership is when you are thinking about 20 years down the road and how, going to what I hear constantly, everybody's pretty happy with what they have in their community, then maybe being a leader is how do you preserve that and maintain that and sustain that. And so maybe you have to do some things, like create a passport business that people may be initially, why in the world would the city be in the passport business? But if you can generate $1 million a biennium to help sustain your infrastructure, or maintain your streets, then that's leadership in terms of protecting your vision. So I think it's different from every community, but I think you're starting to put guardrails around what that is for you by defining your vision and your goals and not your strategies.
I was going to, I think Mark and I were channeling the same thought. I think our community, if you said what's more important to you is to keep Mill Creek the way it is or to go do something new, I think the majority of the people would say, well, don't lose what we have. And so that's why community preservation is one of our goals. It's a big deal around here. And if you look about it, we're talking about the leadership that happened with Town Center. We are recognized around the state as Town Center was a cool thing, and people came from all over the state to look at it because it was leadership. But Pam related the story. It took 20 years from when Dr. Schmidt first had that kind of idea, he and others had that idea, to when it came to fruition. Go back even further, UDC and their vision for MCCA. MCCA is a leader and has been a model for community associations and the way to develop it. That's the foundation of this city. And it goes way back, and they had a very long vision. And so, yeah, it turned out to be a leadership kind of thing, but it came from a lot of long thinking and methodical planning and a lot of different things. And so I think sometimes my first reaction to that comment, too, was like, ooh, I don't want to get out in front. I don't want to be on the bleeding edge. I've done that in the private sector, and it's dangerous and difficult. But you can be a leader by being purposeful and thoughtful and having a long-term direction that you're going to. Instead of long-term planning, you really plan a long-term direction, and then you execute towards that direction, and that direction is something that's good. And I think that's – so I'm okay with that part of it. But when you people start talking about, well, I'm going to lead and I'm going to go out and win this race, I don't think this community is not into winning races. This community is into slow and steady wins the race kind of stuff. That's my opinion.
I think you're all right, but I think we're getting hung up on the semantics of that one word. I mean, I think we have our guiding principles that are going to guide our decisions going forward, and the reality we have is one of our goals is also to have a long-term fiscally sustainable budget. And the reality is we don't have the revenues or won't have the revenues from development like we've had in the past to provide that. So we are going to have to be creative. We're going to have to be not afraid. We're going to have to be leaders, pick whatever word you want to make decisions consistent with our guiding principles of how we're going to deal with that, because just as our citizens want to preserve what we have, they also want to preserve a stable, fiscally responsible government. So I think you're all right, and I think we're getting a little hung up on semantics.
And we're all going to work together and balance each other out.
You know, the hardest time to create change, hardest time is when things are going well. There's no need to change. Easiest time to make change is when things are going terrible, and we're in trouble. We got to make change. So it's a combination of when you look at long range planning for, let's say, our city. What's right about it? What do we want to protect? What do we want to keep? What are the challenges? Because the challenge is, as we look at those and we isolate those are the only things that we're going to want to change. And those challenges that we need to overcome are going to help direct us into what areas we do need to change. We're not going to change the lifestyle that we all cherish so much about this community. We're not going to change that. We're going to protect it. We're going to, if there's something that could damage it, we might want to make some change to ensure its future. But change is, you know, the word about change. Change is always everyone has their own personal definition of it, and I think that in our case, as we go further down this road, and I think we're all saying the same thing, there are parts of this that need to maintain, but we need to be eyes wide open to what we're at risk here. What, you know, you've talked about it so many times. We're not going to have the revenue opportunities from development we've had in the past. Fact. So, what do we need to make a change there? Probably we're going to have to come up with a different solution. What's it going to be? That's where some change might come. But change is fueled by where are the challenges to our community, I think.
And I think that, as so many of you have, you know, told me, right, you moved here, built this community, you know, loved living in this community for what it stood for, and you want to maintain that. And I completely hear that. I think, you know, one of the things that has happened is look at the development around you. What impact is that having on your infrastructure? How many people are coming into the city that don't live here on a daily basis that use services? You know, how many cars are traveling through Mill Creek today versus 25 years ago? And that creates police service and, you know, accident issues and wear and tear on roads and sidewalks and all those things. So, yeah, that's why I think a big part of this long-term planning is when you do want to look and maintain what you have here is really being aware of what's going on around you and planning for that as well, the impacts of that, of what's going on around you.
Anything else? Okay. So, 139. You said it's
I know. Good job.
Did you say at the beginning, we say you want these?
No. No, you can keep those for your notes at the next council meeting. We will have an updated booklet for you that contains just a draft, your sticky notes on paper, if you will, in very rough draft form. And then from that, we will build the strategy statements.
Okay. New business, Exploration Park project.
Thank you. In your packets, you had, I need to get over there. In your packets, of course, you have the agenda summary. I did send out, just as I was thinking last night, you know, this has been a project that's going on, has been talked about and being, has been in progress, if you will, since 2016. And since council members Mead and Steckler obviously were not here during that process, I just wanted to give a little bit of an overview. So I sent the agenda summary out to everyone from June of 17 that just gave kind of a background of how this project came about. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of additional information. This really was a project I don't have anything compared to because it kind of started after I got here, but it had a lot of public involvement between surveys at the festival, having block parties in and around the park, getting feedback, and it was unique in that we really asked the park board and the design review board to work together, and they created basically four concept drawings. And from that, with through the public involvement process, the park board recommended and the council ultimately approved the natural play park theme, and I sent that to you with that agenda summary from June of 2017, excuse me. And so after that process in January of 17, we kicked off the design. Excuse me. And in June, we brought back to the council the construction estimates and design estimates, construction management estimates, and then continued working on the project. Because of contract negotiations, primarily fire and labor contracts going on at the time, we did not maintain the construction schedule, and then I decided to hold off as we brought on our new director, Gina. And so I asked her when she came on board, in addition to 35th, to please kind of review this project. And so she and I have, she has done that, she and I have talked, and then are proceeding underway again. The contract is about 95% design completion, is that correct, correct. Gina? And we are ready to start preparing bids to go out for construction. And just as we did with 35th, the precursor to that is getting the construction management contract before council. If you'll recall from that June of 2017 packet, I believe we had projected construction management at $125,000 to $200,000. The RFQs and reviews came in at $160,140. And with that kind of background laid out to help you as well, I'm gonna let you kind of take it from there and talk a little bit about schedule and what the construction management contract would provide, if you will.
I will add that, like we did on 35th, one of the things that has been done for this project is a constructability and a bidability review has been conducted by KPFF. And so that was the initial task that they had on board. And now this is construction management. As far as the schedule, the project is at 95%. We're planning on advertising next week, probably an ad period of 2 to 3 weeks. We're still deciding that. Two weeks is the minimum. And coming back to council, hopefully for award in May. What else should I say about this?
I think we project about a 20-week construction.
Yeah, the working days. Once we issue the notice to proceed to the contractor, we're estimating 120 working days for construction. Hopefully, a little less, but that is what we're estimating.
Questions?
That is all right.
So, talk first. I got a bunch of questions. Talk first about our reaction to getting only one RFQ. One response to RFQ. I'm not happy when we get a single bid. Tell me why we should do this.
So we advertise the same way we went through for 35th. And for this project, it so happens that we only received one RFQ. And we handled it the same way as if it was a competitive process. We interviewed the consultant team. We had questions already prepared as if we were going to have multiple competitors. So the fact that we only got one is something that is outside of our control.
Do you think it has anything to do with just the unique aspects of the project?
It may be.
Or the limited
busy
cost.
Time of year. That's these types of
multiple, it's market, what's going on in the market. The busyness, maybe interest in other projects. Yeah.
I think it's their peak of time to start thinking about. Mm-hmm.
I do think it's just a little bit, I mean, I think it's a very engaging project. I think it's a little bit, you know, different, the type of park you're has been designed and built here. I mean, it's an exception, not the norm. And so I'm not surprised a lot. But
this is not an unusual project to management. We're talking about construction management, not the construction bid. This is not an unusual project to management. There's nothing unique in this. It's moved some dirt.
You have some park certifications. And so, again, I mean, we're speculating, right?
We're speculating.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if it helps, I did receive feedback from one of the consultants that was interviewed for 35th, the Blue Line Group. And they called me when we issued this RFQ, and they just wanted to clarify for the city that even though they would have liked to submit an RFQ, a proposal, qualifications for this, that because of the work that they had already, the commitments that they had, they weren't able to.
Yep.
So, again, that's just one example, but those are market conditions external to our what's going on in the city.
Me too. I guess I'm just suffering with sticker shock, and I'm looking out for the citizen, and I'm looking out for just what makes sense. So during the budgeting process, we put a wild-ass guess in there, I will admit that, of $500,000. So our CFP and our approved budget, we don't have Peggy here tonight, but our approved budget had $500,000. When we got the update, whenever it was, I couldn't print it, but whatever the update you sent out was sometime in 2017, I had some sticker shock. The cost had gone up from $500,000 to on the order of $860,000 to $1 million. And at the time, I went, whoa, this is not a complicated park. At the time, it was compared to, or we've compared it to other parks. This one doesn't have a bathroom. We've had some very expensive bathroom projects, which I've always struggled with, how we can spend $400,000 building a bathroom when you can build a house for $400,000. But that aside, this one doesn't have a bathroom. This is moving some dirt around. I know it's got a drainage problem. I'll come to that later. But I had sticker shock at the time, but I kind of went, well, okay, let's proceed with that. Now we're looking at $1.3 million. That's another 30%. At some point, I got to say, enough is enough. We can't do this. The home analogy, I'm going to give it, you guys know it. You have $25,000. You're going to remodel your kitchen. You think it's a great deal. But by the time the guy comes in and bids this and that and the other thing, now it's a $50,000 project. Do you just blindly go ahead, or do you say, hold it? At some point, this got too rich for our blood. Now, I love parks, and that park needs something other than grass. I'd love to fix our process by which we got that albatross in the first place. But at some point, our budget, it's going to take a budget amendment to do this right from $500,000 to something more like $1 million. That's $500,000, folks. That's five police officers for a year. It's a city manager for 3 years. It's us for 15 years. Maybe it's more valuable than us for 15 years. We can just go home for 15 years. I get it. I'm struggling. I'm really struggling. And I don't mean to second guess the bid, but maybe these guys who went way over their design contract or their initial design contract. If you look in here, one of their call outs, I just looked at one of them, 19,000 1 gallon plants. Take a guess. What would you go and buy a 1 gallon shrub at the store? Buy a good one. Would you spend $24 for it installed? I don't think so. So maybe this is just government gets screwed by the, excuse my French, gets taken advantage of by the fact we're a government. But nobody in their right mind would spend $1 million to scrape off that dirt, put in subterranean drainage, and put in some fairly simple features. There's no buildings in this. There's no bathroom in this. There's no sewer. This should be simple. And And maybe my rail is against government and contractors and what they price things for. But private sector, if a private sector developer did this, they would laugh at this kind of price tag, $1 million. Brian and his company would probably go, oh, come on, you got to be kidding. At some point, this is just getting out of hand. So I'll get off my soapbox for a minute.
I can't speak to some of those details, but I mean, I share the concerns. I've been surprised too, but at the same time, I think we've had a heads up for some time, and if we were going to pull the plug, we probably should have done that quite some time ago. With that said, this is just our estimate. We haven't got the project bids, so the project bids very well may come in under this, back in line with the previous higher than expected estimate and less than the now higher than the higher, you know what I'm saying? I guess my question is, and I think the question you didn't ask is, with only one bid, are you comfortable that the management fee that they're proposing is reasonable? I just pulled up and I have in front of me the contract we approved for 35th was $611,000. So as I recall, the total budget for that was what, roughly $6 million? So we're looking at a management fee of 10% of the total project cost. Is there a metric that is industry standard for what the management fee should be? Because we're looking at 16% on this contract. So I think the question I was expecting Councilmember Todd to ask that he didn't is, with only one bid, are you guys comfortable that this contract is reasonable and that we're not getting the words that he used a minute ago.
So I feel comfortable with the scope and fee that KPFF has prepared. So 10 to 15% of the construction cost estimate is what's in the industry for construction management. So even though we received only one interested construction management consulting firm, in reviewing their scope and fee, I feel comfortable.
And if I may, I'd just like to address, because I think there are several comments Councilmember Todd, you brought up. First of all, I don't ever want you to feel like you have to rail at us. We're here to do your bidding. The council, it was our understanding this was a project we were continuing with, and that's what we've done. We have absolutely no qualms. If you want to scale the project back, that is a council policy decision. We will support your decisions. I agree, you know, and if you'll recall, I counseled against having a WAG. We had not even designed the project yet, and I suggested that it was really more prudent to design it, project the cost, then come back and update the budget. That is exactly why I came back in June with the updated information we had at that time, because I did not want to get to this point and have the sticker shock and have no one aware of it. You know, we could do this in phases too. We could certainly start with the drainage issue. That's about $250,000, give or take, and I'm completely rounding there. But if you wanted to start with drainage and phase this in over a period of time, that is an option. If you wanted to look in an alternative design, there would be a cost in that because you'd have to go back and redesign. If you'll recall, when we did look at the four concepts, this was the most expensive because it does have stuff built in to dirt, and yes, you know, it's different in that respect. I agree, there's no buildings, but a good bit of this is solving the drainage problem, and those prices that you see in there, Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw is exactly correct. That's not a bid, that's just the bidability review, and we want to always verify costs. I concur with you. It's very frustrating to have to do business the way the state prescribes or the auditors prescribe, because it is not always in the best interest of the public. It's not always the best price, but it is the system we're stuck with, and so I feel your pain, agree with your pain, just not powerful enough to fix the pain necessarily in all respects. So, you know, if the council is feeling uncomfortable, certainly We have the ballpark we're doing. We have Dobson Remillard that we haven't created a vision for. And we also have talked about other community recreation types of projects that you all may want to explore. And if you think this is disproportionate, you have about $3.4 million in that park mitigation fund, then we could certainly scale this project back. Then we could phase it.
How much of that park mitigation fund came from the people that paid into this park? Do we know?
I don't know off the top of my head. I'd be happy to go back and certainly look it for you.
And if we, because you're only asking for the contract management today. So let's say that you go out to bid and it comes in at $2 million for some reason. Seems to be growing.
Yeah.
Would we still have to pay the whole 160 if we decided to put the project on?
No.
So we aren't obligated to move forward at any time we can change our minds.
And we can, you know, I think tonight, you know, there's a couple of options. The council could not move forward with the construction management contract and have a discussion if you want to scale back or phase in the project. Because that would certainly change the scope in terms of construction management. Alternatively, you could proceed with the construction management project and hold off that discussion pending review of bids received. So I think either of those options are available to you off the top of my head.
I'm sure we're going to discuss this further as the numbers are surprising, but do we know how much construction costs are going up each year? I mean, part of this could be because we didn't do it last year, so we're doing it this year. I mean, if we don't do this now, is it going to cost us 20% more next year? Can we get an estimate of how much costs?
Well, you recall when we did the stormwater review with Wildflower, we talked about escalating costs, and I think Councilmember Todd talked about what he'd learned with community transit and some of their escalating costs. Our initial costs are within projection bids on 35th, but this is a completely different animal and very unique. It's hard to say, Gina. I don't know.
So my
from your perspective,
we could factor escalation to a future year if that's what the desired direction mm-hmm. is. In general, in public work circles, the bids like this year have plateaued or we've seen better bids, meaning lower than engineer's estimate. So for a while there, last year and the previous year, we were seeing escalating costs, higher bids than engineer's estimate. That is not the trend that's spoken about in public work circles.
So we could actually come in lower than?
That's correct. And we did, for instance, in 35th.
Okay, thank you. We have lots of green lights, so first up is mm-hmm. Councilmember Cavallari.
I think the concerns about cost are very realistic, and I don't discount them whatsoever. But that being said, we have known it's going to be over $875 for quite some time, so that's not a big surprise to me. I would be against staging the project or putting it off. I'd like to see promises were made to the community. It's important to maintain that bond, and that's truth. Citizen input may have been involved here to, I don't want to say drive the costs up, but they did pick the most expensive of all the choices that they had out of the four categories. And we've kind of hashed this out already, so I mean, if we're talking $100,000 or two, I think we've always known that it's going to be a little bit more than what we had originally. So I'm not surprised. I say green light the project. Let's move on.
I agree with Councilmember Cavallari on some of his points. I think we did create an expectation. I think in retrospect we shouldn't have put a swag in because I think we may have created a false expectation for ourselves of what this is going to cost. Putting it off or phasing it, as long as we continue, I mean, I think what we're going to be suffering from with the cost is just the demand to get contractors to do the jobs as long as the economy stays strong. So if we put it off or phase it, the cost will go up. How much? Who knows? The question I have is, when do we go out to bid?
Next week. At this time, we're scheduled for next week.
So would that work if we wanted to see a phased construction schedule? Is that something that you would work with? If the bid is, has it already gone out, or so we still have an opportunity to revise the bid?
We have an opportunity to revise the PS&E packet, meaning the bid packet.
Right,
that
right.
revision will take time, and it has not been advertised yet. The plan is to advertise it next week.
Okay, so how would it, would, if we decided we wanted to see what phasing would look like, would that affect what is bid out? Would we only bid out a phase, or would we bid out the contract for the contractor to build it in phases?
So if you're talking about phasing it over multiple years, you know, developing, like maybe doing drainage in 1 year, and then you're doing what we call that base project 2 or 3 more years down the road, and then maybe the add-ons and, you know, 2 or 3 more years down the road, then, yeah, you would just bid out your initial phase.
Yeah, I guess where I'm leaning is, in light of our discussion, I think in this circumstance, given the concerns over the cost, I think, and this is no fault of anyone's, I just think we might be considering these in the wrong order. I'm wondering if we need to put the contract out to bid, see what kind of bids we get, see, I mean, my sense is it's going to be one discussion if we're $100,000 under what we're projecting, and a different discussion if it's $100,000 over or more. And I'm inclined to suggest we get that bid out, see what kind of response we get, and then come back to this. Or if we do move forward with this management contract, only move forward with it on the condition that we have accepted a bid for the construction, so they don't start work on the management before we've made a decision on the contract to go forward.
And they help evaluate that, don't they?
Correct. Well, not the bids, but they would not. The KPFF contract would not be activated unless we have a construction phase. So as far as the bids, SVR, who's a current design in contract, the design firm in contract, they would help us evaluate the bids.
So if we did approve this contract tonight, the way it's written, we would not be obligating to pay a dime under it unless and until we approve the contract for the construction?
Correct.
Makes me feel better.
And I really don't have heartburn holding the contract till the bids come in.
I think that makes more sense to me.
Yeah.
Why do we need to prove it now?
Yeah.
Bids in, let's find out if the, you know, where the project's going. Totally.
Sure.
We'll be glad with this.
Do you have concerns that they may take on other work and not be available for us if we don't sign the contract? And if we could agree to the contract and then not do, for some reason, if something goes wrong, not do construction, we're not out. But if we don't go with the contract, and then we want to proceed, and it's 2 or 3 weeks, will they take on more work?
I don't have those concerns, because they understand that their contract, KPFF understands that their contract is contingent on a construction phase. So they understand that.
Do we can approve it. I'm sorry.
Do we have a certain time limit that we've got to accept this contract the way it's been bid? Is there a time limit? Or
it's a scope and fee, so it's not a bid.
Okay.
And do you think there's a danger that they might take on additional work and not be available to us when we came back to them in a month?
I don't think so, because we're still on the same project schedule now. Okay. If we revise the PS&E packet and we have to delay the whole advertising, there is that possibility, because they have to address their own staffing issues.
Okay. Councilmember Todd?
Thanks. You guys have already kind of circled around on something I was going to head to, but I got to go back first to a comment that was made earlier. Yes, indeed. I may have complicated this by saying what was in the budget and in our CFP is $500,000. And you're right. It was a WAG, and there's danger in doing that. So that's why I swallowed hard and accepted the 875-ish kind of number when it was brought to us last June. But the comment was made earlier by a different councilman that he wanted to greenlight the project because at 875 to $1.3 million, is okay with him. And that is a 50% increase. I cannot accept a 50% increase over what we nodded our heads about before. So this is a big deal for me. I'm not going to take this and go, oh, let's just go ahead because some citizens made some input. I'm sorry, but that's $400,000 more money. It's 50% increase from what we agreed to last June. So I want to be clear, this is not a minor thing. Second thing is, I don't know why we've gotten this why this is in front of us tonight. I was going to ask the question. I think it's already been answered. I I feel much more comfortable in the future, in this one and in the future, construction contract and construction management contract come together, because then we don't have this problem of knowing, are we going to turn somebody on and start spending money ahead of time? So I'd prefer that we defer this until we have a construction management, a construction contract to accept and know we're going to move forward. Or if we do this tonight, I'm going to propose an amendment that the no money be spent on this until we have a satisfactory construction bid and acceptance by this council. Thanks. So you could have talked me up to 10.66, but you can't get me to 1.31 very easy.
That's fine. But it wasn't just...
This practice of... I never want to see anything priced in millions again. Maybe the county does it that way. But hundreds of thousands of dollars. Give me the dollars.
I'm sorry you lost me.
This chart, estimate cost of $1.131 million. Design 0.09 million, it makes it sound like a little number. These are big numbers for our city. These are huge numbers for our city. $100,000, Greg, you go get a cop.
Well, no, because it's not the same fund. So I've got to just clarify that. And I think...
But I'm saying that it's money's money. Money is money. It's real money. Citizens have provided this money through one channel or another. Yes, this came through mitigation, but the dollars are dollars. Yes, there's different colors of dollars in terms of how we can spend them, but $100,000 is a lot of money, and it's important to me.
Well, it's important to all of us.
Thank you.
And I hope you know that. I think, you know, I'm not quite sure what to say about the comment about how the information is presented, because I think it's just standard ways of presenting information from an engineering perspective. I certainly... from a staff perspective, we can tell you certainly no intent to try to make it look smaller. We're trying to bring everything to the council to be as forthright and upfront, which is exactly why last June we brought the updated estimate, so that you would know where this was going and could change course if you wanted to. Again, we are here to effectuate what it is the council wants to do, and we are not advocating one way or the other. We are presenting you with the information. We are presenting you with options, and we're happy to do what the council wants to do. And I'm a little concerned that there appears to be almost an anger here, and I don't want that certainly to be the case.
I apologize if I'm coming across as angry. I'm surprised. I'm just surprised. Sticker shock is getting to me. And so if this is it's going to be $1.31 million or $1,310,000 for the total project, and, oh, gosh, the bids came in great. They're $50,000 less. Hooray. We got a discount. I'm just expressing that the sticker shock was palpable to me. My heart stopped when I saw this number. It is not – I'm not going to take it easy. This has got to be a serious discussion. And I don't really want to phase the project. I'm just flabbergasted at the price.
We need a motion. I think we've circled around a gazillion times. I like your idea of a motion to approve with the condition, but given our discussion, I would rather, my suggestion would be, let's get the bids in and stop arguing over what might or might not be, see what it says, and then make some decisions on both the contract and the management contract. I think everyone has said they're in agreement on that. So let's get the bid in and hope that they come in lower than what we are projecting, and then make some decisions. First have the conversation on whether to move forward with the project, and then we can get to the management contract. That would be my suggestion. I don't know if you want a motion or if you just want...
No,
head nods from us if we're in agreement with that.
Yeah, I think we just put it on old business and come back when we get the bids in.
Yeah, we're all ready to go. Let's go get the bids. We're all ready to publicize it.
Yeah, I don't think that's a problem.
Let's not slow it down.
Okay. So now we're up to consent agenda. The one item is the minutes from February 27th, 2018. Do we have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Passed unanimously. We're down to reports, and I'm going to skip it tonight so we can get our city manager home.
Yeah.
Mark?
No report.
No report.
No report.
Very briefly, at SCT, as expected, they voted to recommend against moving policy DP2A forward. We were the lone city, again, that I think actually discussed and made an informed recommendation, but it is what it is. I do not foresee Councilmember Ryan moving that policy forward for a variety of reasons. The swap policy, as they call it, DP2A, is in front of the council tomorrow for a public hearing and possible action. So I'll be testifying with my day job hat. I may testify on behalf of the city just to make it, put in the record that we did support the consideration of that policy, as has, I believe, Granite Falls and Everett, but leave it at that.
Thanks. I would make this comment later, and so Peggy's not here, so I don't know. But somebody's question earlier was, how much did those homeowners pay into this park? My recollection in these cases, and this is a policy I think we as a council need to talk about and change. In certain situations, we've said to the developer, if you will give us some land for a future park, we will not collect mitigation. And so I believe $0 came in from those lots that were developed into homes and sold towards that park. And instead, the developer gave us this beautiful, round, circular thing. Looked like a cool idea for a park. But the reality is, they didn't treat it very well. They put some pretty crappy fill in there and stomped it down. And so this irrigation or this drainage problem it's an albatross. And we've had this happen to us before. They give us, we gave you that park. We made these deals, and it sounded like a good idea many, many years ago, and none of these have turned out really all that great. Now, what I think would turn out great is if when the developer was developing this, we said, yes, you may give us that land, and would you please put in a bathroom and some grass and a play structure, and we will give you $300,000 so that when you walk away, those homeowners will have a park that's ready to go, and we won't have to build it at government prices. We would have a lot more parks, and we'd have a lot nicer parks, and we'd have a lot less of these heated discussions where Councilmember Todd gets red in the face. We've got to change this. We cannot do this ever again. There's been too many of these things. This is costing us more than the value we got out of that, and we didn't get any mitigation dollars, I believe. I could be wrong. I'd love to be proved to be wrong. We also need to look at that whole fund, and what's quoted tonight says $3 million in there. But we've got to remember that I think it's put into buckets, and we talked about having those buckets. There's neighborhood parks, and there's community parks, and a big part of that money is community parks. And so, yes, the fund says $3 million, but it's not all available for this one. And third thing is, we've got other places where there's stars on our map for future neighborhood parks, and we can't spend all of our neighborhood park money on this one park without having a serious discussion about what we're going to do about the other places where we've promised neighborhood parks and don't have neighborhood parks. We don't have a capital facilities plan. We all talked about that. We all want it. We're all working on it. That's great. I'm not blaming us for the past. We've got to get to that point. But until we have that vision, at the rate of this being $1 million or $1.3 million, we are about $2 million short in our neighborhood parks fund in my back of the envelope calculation. And so talk about balanced budgets, talk about being in good financial shape. We're dealing ourselves, we're backing into a place where we're in a lot worse shape than we think we are. Thanks.
I just asked what the accountants told me is that, there's North Point specific money left of a balance of about $161,000. Now, I don't know where that came from or how
well
it
could be
designated
that way.
Maybe
they gave money too.
It could have been, it was just moved and said we're going to put that aside for, I have no idea where it came from. And I've asked Scott to opine for me because the park mitigation is, you have community parks and neighborhood parks, but it's not really clear how that's delineated. And there seems to be, from what staff's told me, some history over, you do view some of these neighborhood parks as community parks. And so I'm just trying to get a little bit of a handle around the fund. And then, I'm showing about an $805,000 dollar entry for REIT and other, and I'm not quite sure. It looks like that was some kind of loan from REIT to be paid back with Timber Creek Ranch Community Park Mitigation. I'm not quite sure what that is, so I was actually going to ask the council if you knew what that was.
Timber Creek. There is $1 million that they paid to get the city's support for the
20 years ago with that little the UGH change.
Because that is something that I would agree with Councilmember Todd. I don't know if this is a function of the code, but from the developer's perspective, I don't think they care how the money is used. But if you go back and look at your agreement with then CamWest, which is now Toll, it specifies how much goes to community parks and how much goes to neighborhood. I don't think they care.
They may not, but our formulas that we, from time to time, review, we have to say, here's our projected cost of land, here's our projected cost of development, and therefore your fee as a developer for neighborhood parks is this. And we do the calculation again and say, for community parks, here's your fee. So I think if we don't uphold that, I think those fees are challengeable.
Well, all I'm saying is I want to look at and see what our code says for how, are we tying our hands with how they're allocated? Is there another way to do it? That's all I'm suggesting.
Yeah. So this is more of this policy review,
I think. With CamWest, it was different because it was an agreement. I don't think it was dictated by any code provision. But anyway, I think that is something we should look into.
Well, and that is exactly why I asked Scott to look into it and opine on it for me, because I needed, before the construction contract, to have a sense of what money was actually available. I've always been told there was this balance. This $800,000 related to Timber Creek, it's been on your books for a really long time, but there's no real backup documentation.
It was around $1 million to CamWest.
Yes, it was.
And I don't mean we spent some of that million on something else, is why it's 800, but it was exactly $1 million.
That they paid us to do something specific, or was it general contribution?
It was paid to get the city's support for the expansion of the UGA to include the 40 or 50 acres that is now Timber Creek Ranch as part of the urban growth area.
There was a funny jog that was done at the head of the Little Bear Creek watershed many years ago, while I was on council, but early on, I'm going to guess 2006 or 7 or something.
It was 2006, I believe, after the county's 10-year update in 2005.
So would there have been some kind of development agreement to that?
There is an agenda summary that's very clear about this. If you go back to 2006, good luck. Gina knows how to search the old system to find stuff. You will not find it in the new system.
It's not very long. It's basically a SEPA mitigation agreement that's 3 or 4 pages, if I recall correctly. It's been a number of years since I've looked at it.
If it's SEPA, that's helpful because it's not restricted. So,
second part of my report, and sorry, that's one reason I'm still also angry, I guess, is that I'm going to give a weekly or every council meeting, you guys are going to have to hear from me about how bad our search engine is on our website. And I know they're working on it, but I do not want us to pay a final dollar or any more progress payments to our website developer until this works better. You search for North Point Park, and you get 582 results. The second one, first one of which is Park in North Point neighborhood named Exploration Park. That's a good result. Second one, Ordinance 94-343. Third one, Ordinance 92-287. The words North Point Park do not appear in those ordinances, and there's 582 of those responses. This does not work. I'm not happy. The park would get you thousands.
That's what I mean. Isn't that what that
I put it in quotes. I put it in quotes. The search engine, I can't use that word in council member. The search engine does not work up to my expectations. We promised people that our website was going to be easily navigable, whatever the word is, because of the phenomenal search engine. I know we're having some problems with our provider and their contracts, but this is not done. This is not useful. This is not a good website.
We are working on it. As Mike has pointed out, Councilmember Todd, we have had some struggles with the web provider. The search engine is one of our top two issues that we're dealing with. Since we signed with them, Google in general has pulled its search functionality unless we want to pay extra for Google So that is a loss that happened to all web providers after we signed this one in particular. I know we're looking into it. It's an issue for us. Right now, I don't have a solution for you.
Just so you can keep us updated on our progress.
I might not have weekly updates, but we're sure working on it, trying to figure it out.
I'll just let you know every time you use it, it doesn't work well. Thanks.
The I have nothing other than a planning schedule.
Okay, audience communication. Anybody going once, twice? Okay, good.
I would request an executive session for the discuss the performance of a public employee for up to 20 minutes under RCW 4231101G.
Okay. So with that, we will go into executive session.
Is there a development agreement?
No, it was.
Gotcha, thanks.
Lots of excitement.